The first column is the Chaldees. And you remember the first timeline that we looked at last week. The Chaldees start roughly in 50 AD, and they continue up until the Roman usurpation of the church. So that's whenever, you remember, Paladus is sent by the Pope to go to Scotland and subdue the Scottish church and make it a Roman Catholic Scotland. That happens in 1107. So the Chaldee period in Scottish church history spans from the 1st century to the 12th century. And below, I just have a few characteristics that I wanted to point out that we didn't really get to discuss last week. So what characterized the ancient pre-Roman Catholic Church of Scotland? Well, here's the list. Now, the first row is, you will find the word Christocentric. And it's a large word, but you understand the meaning. Christ is the center, right? And what's that referring to? Well, it's referring to their view of salvation. All of salvation comes exclusively through union with Christ. I want you to think about that. First of all, this is the pre-Roman Scottish church. And they're preaching that the only way that you and I receive grace is through union with Christ. We have records of this historically. The Venerable Bede argues that this was the chief sin of the Scottish church. And Bede was, of course, a contemporary of the Chaldees. So, what does it mean that Christocentrism runs the Chaldean church? Well, it means that the gospel was preached. So you have, from 50 AD to the 12th century, the pure preaching of the Christian gospel in Scotland. But if you look over into the next column, this is under the Roman usurpation, you have the word sacerdotalist. That one's not so forthright. So if Christocentrism means that grace comes exclusively through union with Christ to the believer, does anyone want to take a guess as to what sacerdotalist means?
It's not taking the sacraments?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So in medieval Romanism, and this is before the influx of what we would call nominalism, or just a deviant form of philosophical theology, the sacerdotalist system argued that you receive grace as you participate in the sacraments. And the order is really simple. God invests the church. C-U-R-C-H. I can't spell today, I'm sorry. God invests the church over which the Pope is head. The Pope then ordains, and we can go through the hierarchy here, but and then finally, you have just your common everyday priest. And the priest communicates to the elements grace. This is one of the big debates in the medieval church. Is grace something of a substance? Is it something that can be contained in the elements of the bread and the wine? The sacerdotalist system began to adopt the idea that it could. And you all know what that most famous expression of sacerdotalism is in the Lord's table. Transubstantiation, right? The elements are turned, the elements themselves essentially are transformed into the essence of the body and blood of Christ, while the accidents, you know, the taste, the touch, the sight, remain the same. So, that's the sacerdotalist system. Why is this important? Well, it's important because previous to this, you had what? You had the pure preaching of the gospel. Now in Scotland, from the 12th century to the 16th, you have this gospel being preached. That's important. Because, and this is why we're going through this, what are the claims of Rome? The claims of Rome is that they have the corner on antiquity, right? They'll say, we are the ancient church. And they get people by the masses by that simple argument. But the truth of the matter is, Scotland is one of the best examples of the fallacy that's being committed there. The sacerdotalist system is new to Scotland in the 12th century. The gospel is what has been silenced. And so what you have in the Reformation, we're going to the third column now, in Scotland, is you have a return, not something new being created, The Reformation was not the establishment of something new, but the reintroduction of something which was old. And that is the Christocentric, or the pure preaching of the gospel. So, we talked about that a little bit last week, but I kind of wanted to review that and ask you guys if you had any questions, comments, thoughts even. Yeah.
As far as antiquity goes, Rome also, we know, struggled with establishing their authority with the Eastern Orthodox Church also. Mm-hmm. And as far as time period goes, the Eastern Orthodox, they go back as far as the Chaldees also?
Yeah. So the what we would call the Pentarchy was a group of churches that were not governed by the Bishop of Rome. They asserted their own national authority, and they existed in the period of the Chaldees, independent of recognizing any papal supremacy. The problem with the Eastern Orthodox, or what we would call the Eastern Orthodox, that's a term that we create after an amalgamation of churches came together, but what happened with the Eastern Orthodox churches is they adopted not the Roman sacerdotalism, but a form of sacerdotalism. I couldn't tell you, though, the years when those things became more prominent in the Eastern churches. But you're right. Rome did have a problem, a very big problem, trying to assert authority over the Eastern churches. And I don't know if I included in our first timeline, but in 1054, when the churches excommunicate each other, that's what's at stake, right? It's an authority issue. And that's actually I'm glad you brought that up, because it's easy to think that the Chaldees were just a group of people who, you know, they were ancient and they didn't have any interest in the churches beyond their borders. But you remember last week we talked about the involvement of British bishops in the ecclesiastical councils. I mean, Nicaea, for instance, they're there, and then Chalcedon and so forth. So the reason why the Chaldees remained separate was not because they just didn't know any better. It was a principled thing. Which actually brings us to our second row here. The Chaldees were, and I should have put quotes here, I'm coming from a very particular point of view. So this is also an apologetic, but I'm more than happy to share with you my sources and everything. I have everything footnoted. But the Chaldees arguably had a Presbyterian form of church government. That doesn't mean it looked identical to what we call Presbyterianism today. There were forms, there were things that they did that we wouldn't do, and vice versa. But here's the nitty-gritty. The Chaldees found themselves governed by presbyters, and those presbyters were not communicated any higher spiritual authority one over the other. Okay? That looks an awful lot like Presbyterianism, especially when they get together. You have records of these early councils in the church deciding on judicial matters, and they elect what they call the president. Today, the equivalent would be the moderator. They elect the president, and what he does is he presides over something relative to the church, and those things that are decided in that council are brought down to the lower congregations in the realm. That looks an awful lot like simple, basic Presbyterianism. Now, that is starkly contrasted with what we see in Roman Catholic Scotland. You have papal authority. You have the establishment of a hierarchy. You have the establishment of the supremacy of the Pope. And, of course, everything follows through with that. Now, what John Knox does in the Reformed Church of Scotland is he brings Presbyterianism back. That's actually where we're going to focus most of our attention today. We're going to talk about the struggles between the Reformed Kirk and Presbyterianism and Roman Catholicism. And we're also going to be introducing another category, and that would be the Preletical, or the Episcopalian Scotland. So we're going to come back to that chart later. You may have that printed out on a study guide in future weeks as well, so you don't have to keep bringing this back. But I want you to think with me for a moment about where we ended up last week. We ended up with the death of a man. You guys remember the name of that man? Good.
thinking.
Oh, okay. Sorry. I thought that was a hand.
You can do it.
So he was the reformer for Scotland. He was
Knox.
Yep. John Knox. We talked a little bit, but we didn't talk a lot about what those reforms looked like. But we just mentioned one of the big things. What happened to the Reformed Kirk of Scotland? It became Presbyterian. Okay? In 1560, you have the establishment of what we call the Scots Confession. And in that confession, you have the government of the church clearly organized. You also have the pure preaching of the gospel. You have the establishment of biblical doctrine once more in the church. But you have a Presbyterian system of church polity. That means that there's no higher spiritual authority communicated from one minister to another. But in the main, in the general assembly, or what we would call it, in that assembly, the church is governed by these presbyters. It's a model that we all know we find in the book of Acts, Acts 15, the Jerusalem Council. That comes back to Scotland. But glance at your timeline with me just for a second. And there's an interesting date that you need to remember. Oh, I have one. That's okay. January 16th, 1572. This is an important, important date, especially for what we're going to be talking about this week. In January 16th, 1572, something is established in the church that Knox didn't bring in. Something called the Tolkien Bishops were ordered and forced upon the church at the Convention of Leith. Now, what's a Tolkien Bishop? Well, you'll see that the word there is italicized. The reason why that is because it's a Gaelic word. But this is the word that everybody used. A Tolkien was something, it was kind of like a stuffed animal, like a primitive stuffed animal. And if you wanted a cow to give milk, you knew that you needed to have something that looked like a calf to stand beside her. And so what would happen is they would make these Tolkiens, set them beside these cows, and the cows would produce more milk. So a Tolkien bishop, this is, by the way, they didn't call themselves Tolkien bishops. Okay. Yeah, they didn't equate themselves to a stuffed cow. But what the Presbyterians thought of these is pretty clear. You have these guys who are, they have the name of a bishop, but you know, they don't have all of the authority of a bishop. They're kind of like this moderated church office that doesn't really exist, but it does. And the motivation for that was that if you have these bishops in place, more money can go to the king. Why is that? Why do you think that a bishop would be advantageous for the wealth of the king? Yeah?
People would buy
it. Yeah.
By the office.
Yeah.
They would buy the office. So they pay the king to be a bishop.
Uh-huh. Yep.
So this is after the reform. This is,
yep,
this is the Reformed Church installing bishops.
Yeah. Forced upon the Reformed Church by the king. At the Convention of Leith. But yes, you have these bishops. Now understand this. Could they actually force episcopacy, that is the order of bishops and not presbytery, could they force it on the Church of Scotland legally? Not in its fullest form. Because you remember in 1560, the Scotch Confession is ratified publicly and civilly. So they had to have this moderated view. And so a Tolkien bishop, though he didn't have the full authority that an Episcopalian bishop would have, what he would do is he would govern, you know, like church properties. He was like a glorified deacon. But the idea was, and this is going to hold true for our history, the idea is if you have these guys who are governing church property, eventually you start to give them more and more spiritual authority. So it's kind of like sticking your foot in the door. That's all that this is. They couldn't do it. They couldn't just force episcopacy on the Church of Scotland at this time. They had to do it step by step, basically. So on January 16th, this happens. Now, in your timeline, the next event is the death of Knox. John Knox's death marked the end of the First Reformation. And the Church of Scotland doesn't look like it's healthy. She has these bishops who are just pawns in the hands of the king, and that's how she's going to go. So, for the next several years, we're going to be dealing with these Tolkien bishops and their effect on the Church of Scotland. But the biggest event that we have to focus on with regard to these bishops is what we would call the controversy of the Glasgow bishopric. So let me give you the context. The Church of Scotland is trying to figure out what to do with these glorified deacons. And in that context, the king decides he's going to flex his muscles. We're talking about James VI. So James VI sees that one of his bishoprics is vacant. It's open. The previous occupier of that office has died. So James orders that a particular man fill that pulpit. Notice I said pulpit, and not just bishopric. What James is advocating is that this particular man of his own choosing is going to depose the interim pastor and put this guy in his place, and he's going to have control over the spiritual well-being of the Glasgow congregations and over its physical property. That's quite the step, right? That's not what the Tolkien bishops were designed to do, but that's what James decides he wants him to do. So what happens? Well, a man by the name of Robert Montgomery is chosen by the king, and because the king knows he has to still run it by General Assembly receives this request. Let's put Robert Montgomery into the bishopric of Glasgow. There's a problem. If there wasn't one already. Montgomery is an adulterer. His preaching is suspect at this time. And worse than that, he's running up debts all over the place. So the General Assembly returns with a rather firm answer. There's no way. Now, I don't know if you and I mean, we are Americans, so we're rather kind of divorced from this context, but I don't imagine that any of us would have a hard time imagining what James VI's response would be. He wants a guy in there, and he's being told no. How do you think a king is going to respond to being told no? Well, it's not going to be pleasant. So, now the saga begins. The drama, the stage is set, the drama begins. James VI says, I don't care what the General Assembly says. And by the way, the General Assembly is the highest court of the Church of Scotland. And James is saying, now I have authority over her. That's not Presbyterian. Who is Zion's only king and head? Christ, not James VI. So this whole debacle is going to swirl around who really has control of the Reformed Kirk. The king says, I don't care what the General Assembly has decided with regard to Montgomery. I'm going to put him in there. Well, I mean, I already told you some of Montgomery's character, but I think you and I both know who Montgomery is hoping will win out in this debate. He's hoping James VI will get his way. And so Montgomery decides to take it upon himself, of course, with the king's guard, to enter into the Glasgow Cathedral in the middle of a service and to try to pull the minister out of the pulpit. He's going to take the bishopric by force, and he has the king's military support. However, there are a few pious dukes and lords that are there, and they tell him to cease immediately. So there's this weird and awkward situation that Montgomery finds himself in. The Glasgow Assembly says, the General Assembly says you cannot have Glasgow. James VI says you can have Glasgow, and now Glasgow's saying to Montgomery, you can't have us. So what's going to happen here? Well, if you look in your timeline, April 12, 1582, James VI threatens anyone who refuses to allow Montgomery to take the bishopric. Things are starting to mount here. Under Knox, the Reformed Kirk was able to make these decisions freely. I mean, they didn't have bishops. you know, in Knox, Scotland. But they did have the freedom to choose who would go in any particular pulpit. James VI is saying that's now being denied you. That right to put your ministers in a particular place is no longer part of the congregation's authority, no longer part of presbytery, no longer even part of General Assembly to decide who is fit to take office. So, he threatens anyone who refuses to accept Montgomery. Now, you read the history here and you're like, it seems almost toddler-like. But what happens is the General Assembly also makes a response. And the next entry on your timeline gives you that response. Montgomery is tried, and he's found guilty of all of the things and even more than what I've just told you. He's also found guilty of trying to presume upon the authority of General Assembly by taking the bishopric that General Assembly denied him. And so he's excommunicated.
Did he actually pull the preacher out of the pulpit?
Nope. The lords and the other nobles in the congregation at that time had their guards.
Okay.
Yeah. So Montgomery is still out of an office at this time. And now he's excommunicated. Now, if you're excommunicated, in our day and age, that's not that big of a deal. But if you're reading the Scots Confession and you're looking at the way that the civil magistrate interacted with the church at this time, that denied you not only ecclesiastical office, it denied you political office. You were essentially reduced to nothing. You could become a weaver or a shepherd if you'd like. But that's about it, really. So this is a pretty heavy-handed move, I think a right move by General Assembly, but James VI disagrees. Now, Montgomery, and you have to imagine, you know, you have to imagine what Montgomery's thinking at this point. He's like, the king wants me there. The General Assembly's just said that I'm outside of the visible church. I don't know what else to do. So he goes back to the king and he's like, listen, you need to fix this for me because I can't do it. I no longer have a voice. So James VI does, in a sense, try to fix it. At the cross market, and at every public cross in the city of Scotland, Montgomery is proclaimed Bishop of Glasgow by order of James VI. Think about that for a second. On paper, the Reformed Kirk of Scotland has full authority in matters ecclesiastical. And now James VI is saying, I'm putting this man in there despite the fact the General Assembly not only does not want him there, but has found him guilty of heinous sins and has excommunicated him. That's a very heavy-handed thing. So you get this impression that after Knox dies, the Reformed Kirk is in bad, bad shape. So what happens? What happens whenever a church is compromised in her authority? What happens whenever a king is usurping more authority than he has in his own civil constitution? What happens whenever a people are confused as to who to believe? I mean, think about this. Let's say you live in Glasgow at this time. You have to pay taxes. And you have to pay taxes to a bishop. Who do you pay taxes to? Do you suffer and not pay taxes because you decline any pretended authority Montgomery has? And so side with General Assembly? Or do you pay? I mean, that's going to be the question, and we're going to face that for the next several weeks, because in Scotland, those kinds of questions are going to become the chief cornerstones that build the conflict that will arise in Scotland at this time. Scotland's in an up... Oh, Hermosa.
What is the current view as in, because you were saying it's... things that they were so aligned that once you were excommunicated, you know, everything kind of like fell apart. Yeah. What is the view of what it should look like? Should it look that way, or should it be like there's be some space to like be able to provide for yourself or whatever?
Yeah. So I'm going to give you the answer that the Reformers then, the second Reformers would give you, and they'd say it should be that way. And we're actually going to talk a little bit about why they thought that. I have a few quotes that I'm going to read as we go through.
I have a question, too.
Yeah.
So, I'm a little bit confused with the timeline that there was the Chaldee, and then for 400 years, there was the Papists.
Yes.
And then there was the Reformed. Mm-hmm. And that hit just about not too soon before this. Mm-hmm. So how did the Papist period change Scotland? I mean, it seems like, you know, after 400 years, they'd be sort of Papists.
Yeah.
Okay. And then John Knox comes in and says, no, your roots are, I mean, can you say a little bit more? Because that would kind of set the stage for what the people would be thinking. And,
That's great. I'm glad you brought that up. So Roman Catholic Scotland was notoriously, their bishops, their church hierarchy was notoriously compromised with the royalty. In fact, it was so bad that the papal offices in the Vatican understood that they needed to keep sending men over there to try to reform and get the money out of the hands of the king in Scotland and into the hands of the Pope. So, actually in Scotland, and I'm glad you mentioned this because this is really important to understand the place of the Tolkien bishopric. What would happen is a king would find a man that he thought would be pliable. A man that he thought he could easily persuade to start giving him money. And that's the guy who would end up being a Roman Catholic bishop. So the idea is... The idea is, you know, a bishop is kind of the tax collector, the ecclesiastical tax collector for the king. And so that's why these Tolkien bishops kind of came back. The Reformers did away with them. Knox, Buchanan, those men decided there was no place for them in a Reformed church. But now that Knox's ministry comes to a close, Buchanan is on his deathbed, why not bring him back?
And it hadn't been that long.
Yeah. We'll bring him back, and we'll have a modified office, you know, to appease the Presbyterians, but also bring revenue in for the king. So you're thinking about Montgomery in that context. You're thinking about, you know, well, my great-grandfather paid taxes to a Roman Catholic bishop in this district, and that guy was hired by the king. Maybe I should just pay to Montgomery. So that's kind of the conflict that would have been happening on the grassroots level at this time. Now, because of this confusion, and because the lay people were the ones who were most impacted by the Reformers in Scotland, an uprising occurs. And it's over this issue. We call it the Ruthven Raid. It's because it happens at the castle of Ruthven. But the Ruthven Raid was just a group of nobles backed by many, many people. And they essentially imprisoned James VI. They said, and it's interesting if you read the first-hand accounts. I don't have them with me. And for the sake of time, I won't go into too much detail. But when these Protestant Presbyterian nobles imprisoned James VI, they say, we think that the reason you're making these bad policy choices is because of bad counselors. So what the Ruthven Raiders do is they basically strip James's court of all of these people they thought were suspect. And it's interesting. James VI was, he might have been many things, but he wasn't an idiot. Because when James VI interacts with these raiders, he comes away and he says, oh yeah, you're right. You know, these counselors, they've just been poisoned and they've just been pulling it in my ears. And you know, I just couldn't help myself. I had to sign that paper and all of that. I'm so glad you came, right? Thank you for imprisoning me. So that's what James VI says. And, you know, the policies start to change. If you look, just look at your outline there. The next thing, September 1582 to June 1583, you have what we call the Ruthven administration, where this new Protestant Presbyterian court is the ones who are nearest the king. And look at what they did. They overturn Montgomery's appointment, and they do this with the king's signature. Okay? I don't think they had a halberd or a claymore pressed against the king at this time. So they have Montgomery deposed, And James VI relinquishes any pretended authority he had over church and even over matters of state that defied his constitution. James VI was not only becoming an absolute monarch in the church, he was also demonstrating that in the state. He was levying taxes and doing things contrary to Parliament over and over again at this time. And you know, at this time, James is like 25, 26 years old. So, you know, he's barely thinking at this stage. So if you flip the page, here's what happens. The Ruthven administration isn't pulling any revenue in to the royal checkers, right? The exchequers are not all that happy. Because the Kirk, you know, the Kirk is fine. She's happy. She has her Presbyterianism, at least in some sense, back. Montgomery's no longer in the equation. Just church.
Church.
Yeah. Yeah, the Reformed Church in Scotland was always called the Reformed Kirk. It's a German thing. I don't know. I'm not a linguist, but that's what they tell me. So, you know, James, who was so happy that these raiders captured him and so happy that he's finally relieved of this court, he flees the castle. He escapes. Then he overthrows the coup regime. And he restores Montgomery. So his colors are going to come out pretty clearly. And sadly, this is just the whole story. I mean, these next 30 years are just, that's all that this is. Now, in February 17th, right after this administration, right after the year-long occupation of the king and the imprisonment of him and the reestablishment of Presbyterian law, right after that, James VI jails the most prominent Presbyterian minister, the man who we could argue is the successor to John Knox, Andrew Melville. Andrew Melville was imprisoned because he was willing to preach against the king's policy. He's the only one at this time. But I want you to keep that date in your head. Now, May 1584, Montgomery's excommunication is voided. By who?
Parliament.
By Parliament. Isn't that something? Excommunication. You're put outside of the visible church. That means that a court, a judicatory of the court of Jesus Christ, has ordered that you are outside of the church. And the state says no. I mean, we all understand, after we just talked about the effects of the excommunication, that there were consequences civilly to an excommunication order. But Parliament, at this stage, is saying, I don't care either. With regard to the General Assembly. Now, this is going to put Scotland in an even worse situation than before the Ruthven usurpation. So, Montgomery's excommunication is avoided. Everyone in Glasgow is forced by Act of Parliament and by the backing of the King to support Montgomery's bishopric. Now we have basically the same situation we had before the raid, but it's going to get worse than this. The man who led the Ruthven administration is put to death after he was promised by the king that he would be spared. We have that documentation written and James's signature there clearly. What follows is a series of actions, civil actions taken by James and taken by several men who were leaders in Parliament at this time. Let me read to you just three short things that James and his Parliament enact. First, it is His Majesty's intention that the presbyteries, consisting of many ministers, or otherwise, be no further tolerated in this realm. No further tolerated in this realm. In 1560, the constitution of both church and state required a Presbyterian church government. And now, despite ecclesiastical and civil laws, James VI is requiring that Presbyterianism fall off of the face of the earth. Notice this. This is the second thing that these acts do. It is His Majesty's intention that the bishops or commissioners convene not a general assembly out of the whole realm, notice this, without His Majesty's knowledge and license obtained thereunto. What is he saying? He's saying that even bishops don't have the authority to call an assembly unless I grant them license. Now, this is the last thing I want to read to you from these acts. It is His Highness's intention that the bishops in the realm in every diocese with their council preside into the ecclesiastical government. Now, remember we talked about the Tolkien bishops before. What were they supposed to be in charge of?
Land.
Yeah, land. What does this act say? They run the church. And who runs the bishops, according to the last paragraph? The king. What other church, maybe just a couple hundred miles south, does this start to resemble? Oh, the Roman church, but think more about England and the Episcopalian church. And the king is the head of the church. So, that's what we're looking at here. We're looking at a Scotland that's looking increasingly more like the English Reformed Church. Now, in November 16th...
And that was going on at the same... When was Henry VIII? Is he right around the same?
He would have been a contemporary of Knox. Actually, he would have died before Knox had started his reforms. But the church in England at this time was very much a hierarchical church. At this time, Queen Elizabeth was head of the church, right? November 16th, every minister in the realm is supposed to sign these acts, saying that they are lawful and that they are something that they will adhere to. What if you're convinced that Presbyterianism is the only mode of biblical government? What happens if you're asked to sign this paper and you have those convictions? You're in a lot of trouble. You're in a lot of trouble. So, as you can imagine, a good number of these Presbyterian ministers didn't sign the document. And so there were civil ramifications. Many of them were forced out of their parishes. And to be forced out of your parish may not seem like a big deal. You can move on to another land. They're forced out with their families. And when you're forced out of your parish, it's not because you didn't get along with these group of people. You were forced out of the parish because the government decided you could no longer be a minister. Which means you can't preach anywhere else. So you have no means of employment unless you happen to be noble. If you were a minister who was from a noble family, you'd probably be okay. But to be evicted from your parish, for some people it was a death sentence on you and your family. Especially in the north of Scotland. You being forced from your parish in the Highlands was you being forced into the mountains and dealing with angry Roman Catholics and bears. And honestly, I would take the bears. Genuinely. So this was a big deal. Scotland is not looking healthy. It doesn't look like Knox's church. It doesn't look like the Church of the Chaldees. It's increasingly looking, and someone mentioned it, it's increasingly looking like Rome. It's what it's looking like. Rome, but with an Anglican twist. Now, again, because the Scots are ornery people, they decided that we've had enough of this. So once again, the king finds himself in a castle surrounded by angry Protestants. And James VI does the exact same thing he did at Ruthven Castle, but he does it here at Stirling Castle. At Stirling Castle, he has all of these nobles coming up to him and saying, "We don't want to kill you," and I don't understand this. Maybe you guys can help me. But whenever somebody says, the first time you confront them, they say, "You know, I'm glad you came. I'm glad you know you're putting me in prison. I'm glad that you got rid of those evil counselors." And then he escapes and does everything that those counselors wanted him to do. are you going to believe him a second time?
No.
Whenever he opens the door and says, thank you for coming. Like, welcome, welcome. No, but that's what they did. James VI surrenders himself to a force of Presbyterians outside of Stirling Castle. And finally, the government under Lennox is destroyed. So Lennox, if you look at your timeline on the first page, Lennox was a papist who supposedly converted Protestantism. He was something like the prime minister at that time. So he was like a king's second-hand man. Well, he's no longer in the picture. He's exiled, he goes to France, and he dies a drunk on the streets of Paris. Now, this is interesting. As soon as Lennox leaves the realm, the Church of Scotland receives some comfort. The General Assembly is allowed to meet. And the General Assembly doesn't petition for a license from the king. It seems it's not, there's no official documentation, but it seems as though part of the stipulations that the Protestant nobles gave to James was that he was going to relax to the what we would call the Black Acts, which would have required a license from the king, and would have required that bishops presided over the order and over the government of that assembly. So a free assembly is held May 11th, 1585, and Presbyterianism begins to get back on its feet.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
So you have the king who has surrendered himself.
Yeah.
So who is the government? Is the church, the General Assembly, taking over?
So it's actually just Presbyterian nobles.
Presbyterian nobles.
Yeah, so a man who was the Earl of Arran at this time. Arran is an island in Scotland. He takes Lennox's place as prime minister, essentially. And under his guidance, Scotland returns to something of Presbyterianism. And that's really the end of the Black Acts. So, what does Scotland look like at the end of this? Well, the peace of the church is kind of on shaky ground, isn't it? She's went through two waves of imposition by the king. She has these bishops, and who knows what they're supposed to be doing. And, I mean, after all, who is supposed to be Bishop of Glasgow at the end of this? It's interesting, but that's still debated, and that's how many years out? Yeah, it's still debated, even into 87, which is 3 years after the excommunication is supposedly relieved off of Montgomery's head. So you have a church in Scotland that is really on the edge. But for 3 years, she seems to be doing well. So if you're looking at your study guide while you're looking at your timeline, we're moving into part three, which is Prelacy's descent. We're going to speed up a little bit here. We don't have much to talk about after this. But Prelacy's descent. So a prelate is a bishop. That's what you should be thinking here. So Prelacy's descent in Scotland is going to start with the threat of the Spanish Armada. Do you guys remember reading about the Spanish Armada in high school and things like that? Supposedly one of the most important events in world history, in Western world history, and probably so. It was an attempt by the King of Spain to bring Britain back to Roman Catholic subjection. And so what James does is, well, James is probably a Roman Catholic by conviction. But James knows that any money that he gets from the bishops in Scotland, if they become Roman Catholic, they don't go to the king. They go to the Pope. So James has a personal interest in keeping Scotland from falling into papist hands. And so the threat of the Spanish Armada actually works favorably for the Kirk of Scotland. So in 1588, you have the defeat of the Spanish Armada, and I should mention this. I don't want to keep jumping back and forth. But in the previous year, James's mother was killed by Elizabeth I. And this is just a personal anecdote to give you like the kind of character James was. Whenever he was told that his mother died, he danced around the room and was overjoyed to the point where all of his servants locked his chamber doors so that nobody could see how terrible he was acting. I mean, this guy was not, he wasn't a good guy. But James decides he's going to be favorable to the Reformed Church regardless in this time. And he decides that the best way to defeat popery, that is Roman Catholicism, is to support the Presbyterian cause. And so he comes into the General Assembly, and you know, the guy had so many masks, but he comes into the Presbyterian Assembly, General Assembly, and he says, "I'm so thankful that the Lord made me king of a place in which the government of the church was at its most pure." Right? Just a few years ago, he was saying that, you know, they actually didn't have the authority to excommunicate a man. They had no authority to put a guy into the bishopric or hold a guy back from it. This guy is so two-faced, it's scary. But James VI supports the Presbyterian cause. And because of that, in 1592, the church receives what she's always wanted. From the time of Knox's death to now, the church wanted a civil charter that said she was free. She had the right to govern herself. And that's precisely what she receives. And the Tolkien episcopacy, those bishops, are kicked out. And so now you have Presbyterianism as Knox envisioned it, the Presbyterianism which Melville had so long preached for and prayed over, it was finally here. As a testimony to this, there was a covenant renewal in the Presbytery of St. Andrews. And so it seems as though the Reformed Church, even under James's administration, has received everything she wanted. Her doctrine was purer than it ever had been. Her polity now was returned back to the purity of the First Reformation. She looks like she's finally healthy. But catastrophe strikes in 1596. And your timeline is called the Hurly-Burly in Edinburgh. So what is that? Well, Hurly-Burly is just a kerfuffle. Jeez, another funny word. There was a mistake that was made in St. Giles Cathedral. Men thought that James VI was back to his old tyrannical ways, and so they decided to take matters into their own hands. They went down to the king's palace while he was meeting with his council and threatened to kill the king because he was usurping authority over the church, or so they thought. Now, whatever benefit James thought that he had to support the Reformed Kirk, after this event, he's not so confident. In fact, he has a rather low view of many of those ministers. Many of them, like Melville, were simply devout Presbyterians who had been misunderstood. There are three or four letters that were written to the king within a span of 3 or 4 hours by these ministers, explaining what happened, apologizing vehemently for this, but the king had decided that this was because of Presbyterianism. And we eventually begin to see why. In 1598, the king, who was classically trained, put forth his first book, which was the Law of Free Monarchies. And in that book, you discover something very interesting. James believes that the only way a man can rule properly is if he has bishops in his kingdom. In fact, this is where the phrase was coined: "No bishop, no king." So James VI is now off of working on the exact opposite of what he said that he was before, and he's saying that the only way he can survive as a monarch is if episcopacy can be reintroduced. He can't do what he did before, though. He has a problem. And the problem is he has a backstory. The backstory is he keeps going back and forth between episcopacy, and he keeps on promising things to bishops and then rescinding them whenever a Protestant noble gets in a huff about it. And then, you know, he supports the Presbyterians whenever the Catholics are going to arrive, and he needs to play his cards closer to his chest these days. And he knows that. So, if you look at your timeline, you'll see that on December 13th, 1597, James gives the privilege to vote to ministers of the church in Parliament. Now, that's interesting. Somebody tell me why you think that might be interesting.
Trying to fold the church into the civil government.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting, too, because how is James doing this time? Before, he just forced the bishops on. Through Parliament. He's doing it through Parliament. He's using Parliament as his vehicle. But what else is he doing? He's giving them gifts. He's saying, oh, you know what? You guys should have more of a say in government. So keep that in the back of your mind. Because what's going to happen next is going to be a direct result of this particular act. James is hoping that the Reformed Kirk is going to continue to support him. But he wants the Reformed Kirk to look a lot like the Anglican Church. And so, especially after Elizabeth I dies, you remember Elizabeth I, the Virgin Queen, Virginia, the Virgin Queen has no legitimate heir, right? She names James VI, King of Scotland, heir. James VI was second or third cousin to Elizabeth I. And so James VI of Scotland becomes James I of England. And he holds two crowns. The kingdoms remain distinct. They have their own parliaments, their own constitutions. But they now have one person holding two thrones. And that's going to be for quite some time, until 1707. That will be the state of Britain. They'll have one throne, but three different kingdoms, three different parliaments, so forth. After James goes to London, his desire to have episcopacy forced on Scotland increases exponentially. In 1606, he sends out the Act. The Act concerning the estate of bishops. I'm just going to say this really briefly. What the estate of bishops was that you, as a bishop, got your castle back. You remember in the Tolkien administration of episcopacy, you had everything stripped away from you whenever your episcopacy was disbanded by Parliament and by the king. But now the king is giving you that back. Now bishops have castles, they have armies, they have estates. But this is important. In just 6 months, in December of the same year, James VI orders that these bishops become moderators, and I italicize the word constant moderators of presbyteries. These moderators get to determine the government of the church, and remember that date that I said to remember about Parliament giving the right to vote to church officers? Well, the only ones who could vote in Parliament were those who were the constant moderators of presbytery. And who are those people? The bishops. So what has James done? In three acts, what has he done?
The church controlled by the state.
Yeah. And he did it in a whole new way, something that never had been done before. And he did it by compelling the church to think that they were going to be getting more authority than they ought to have had. Some men spoke out against this, but others didn't. And those who didn't played into James's hand. And at that point, the way to bishoprics were reestablished. June 8th, 1610, the General Assembly is called by James VI, and you can read the paragraph. What does James VI do in this golden assembly? Well, in this quote-unquote golden assembly, James reduces the Scottish Reformed Kirk to the ecclesiastical status of the Church of England, as far as her polity is concerned. The king is head of the church. Bishops have ecclesiastical, spiritual, superior power. And all of the previous assemblies that did not meet with the license of James VI are rendered null and void. All of their acts. They're just erased. In 1612... Parliament, just to continue on this track, Parliament dissolves the liberty of the church. You remember, you just flip back the page. The liberty of the church was in June 1592. It was the thing that the church triumphed in. It's now dissolved. James has complete control over church and state. In 1618, just to show where this trajectory is headed, the Perth Assembly meets, and the General Assembly requires the kneeling at the sacraments, private communion, private baptism, secret confirmation, and the observance of festivals. All that Scotland is lacking that the Church of England has is a prayer book. So what's going to happen? I'm going to speed ahead to the last two points. The Church of Scotland has wrestled for her freedom. From the time of the Reformation under John Knox's ministry and after his death till now, it has been a quest to find it the opportunity to have a free assembly, a free general assembly, and her courts would be governed by herself according to the Word of God, governed according to Scripture, governed to the glory of God, and courts over which Christ and Christ alone was head. In 1637, the Lord answers those prayers. Jenny Geddes, an old woman who was sitting in Glasgow Cathedral, sorry, in St. Giles Cathedral in Edinburgh, she listens as this prelate, this man who was placed there by a bishop, begins to read from the prayer book. And it sounds an awful lot like the Roman Catholic Mass. So this woman picks up the stole upon which she had been sitting, and she hurls it at the man in the pulpit, and she says, "Ye will not be saying Mass in my lug," or something to that effect. And imagine a Scottish feminine dialect there. But so she does this, and a riot breaks out. The bishop is forced to go to the roof, the cupola, or whatever you call it, and he has to stay there. He has a pistol in his hand, and he's shooting it at people as they're like running around. I mean, that's the story. Well, what this did was it showed that the common people were tired. I'll close with this anecdote. There was a bunch of these bishops who went down to the south of Scotland at this time. And they spent time among the common people, the farmers, you know, the lay people. And one bishop wrote back to the Archbishop of Edinburgh. And he said, we engaged with these housewives, with these shepherds, with these weavers. We talked about them. And get this, they knew more of the Word of God than our students of divinity. And they could tell us why it was necessary that there was a presbytery and not episcopacy. And it was because, and I quote, it was because their ministers had trained them well in the book. So, in 1638, you have a Reformation, which begins. It's the second Scottish Reformation. If you put your timeline aside and your study guide, and you pick up the massive tome that I gave you, Supplements for week 2. Next week we're going to be talking about these documents. These documents are, if you want to understand the Reformed Presbyterian Church, if you want to understand our history, these are documents you need to read. The Confession of Faith of the Kirk of Scotland, you'll find on your timeline, is March 15th, 1581. And if you flip over 3 pages, page 4, you'll find the Covenant of 1638, which was signed right after Jenny Geddes threw the stole in St. Giles Cathedral. When we come back together next week, we're going to be talking about this document and its importance. So if you look at your study guide, keep this document open, but if you look at your study guide and turn to the back page, you should see a supplemental reading guide. That reading guide goes with these supplements. So there are six questions that we're going to be discussing together next week, and I've given them to you there on that sheet. But I want you to engage with these texts, and I want you to see for yourself those kinds of answers that, I mean, Hermanta brought up about the relationship between church and state, the importance of presbytery, the importance of a free presbytery, the relationship between the lay people and government even, as well as the church and government. I want you to look at these documents with that in mind. And then when we get together next week, we'll talk about what you thought. Sound good? Do you guys have any questions or comments before we close with prayer?